Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a mammoth episode in the sense that we're going to talk about two of the big films, or probably the two biggest films for a lot of people that are out right now, plus a series, a mini series, only mini in the sense that the episodes are smaller, but we'll get to that. But first, Amy, hello.
Hello, Nick. Hi.
This is, I guess, the podcast version of what everyone's talking about of watching the double feature of Oppenheimer and Barbie, which personally I don't think I'd even want to do.
Well, I would never want to do it, except that I did in the sense of I saw them on consecutive days. I mean, what's really unfortunate is, you can't help then weighing them against each other. And that's kind of maybe unfair to Barbie.
I had a bit of time separating them. One other thing that's interesting is that you also have Asteroid City this summer. So you have these three movies that are kind of, I mean, Asteroid City being set in a pseudo version in the 50s, a pseudo 50s. There's even like a atomic blast in the distance at one point in that one. Have you seen that one yet?
No,
Or
I haven't.
oh,
I
okay.
haven't. I think I'm waiting till it streams. I
So
mean,
just
I don't know. That's terrible, but.
But it's funny to have that as kind of an appetizer.
Except that politically, there are forces that want to take us back to the 50s, right? So they're all appropriate.
No, it's absolutely true. So, Oppenheimer, maybe we can start with Oppenheimer since that, I guess, is just by a nose more recently viewed. Maybe just an outline of what it actually covers generally, because I hadn't read American Prometheus, so I didn't actually know what the scope of the movie could be. But I guess it's a matter of what he selected to emphasize. And that was actually part of what I really loved about the movie is the two parts to it, basically. It's in that it's not just the Manhattan Project.
Right. I never read American Prometheus. I kind of read in it when I had heard that he was going to make this movie. I mean, I have the book, but I haven't read all 765 pages. But I just think it is the perfect story for Nolan. And, I'm not a huge Christopher Nolan fan, except for the Batman movies, which I truly love. But I have just problems with the other movies and the way they move around in time and are non-linear and difficult to follow and puzzle-like. But one, I had no problem with this at all. And I think the way he moves around in time is just brilliant in terms of telling the story. Now, I left the movie and was standing outside. Last night outside the 68th Street Multiplex, and I met several film critics who we know well, who are not nearly as enthusiastic as I was about the movie, because at that point I just said, everyone should cancel their Oscar campaigns because this is going to win everything. It's going to win. And they looked at me like I was out of my mind, and they said, "And these are intelligent. Could you follow it? Wasn't it a problem that you couldn't follow the story?" And I said, "Everyone knows the outline of this story, that Robert Oppenheimer was a genius physicist who organized a team that split the atom and built the first bomb and then was pilloried for it afterwards and had a very difficult time recovering for the rest of his life. I mean, what is there to understand? It is the simplest story, and it's kind of an archetypical American narrative about the hero and his fall." And then I was on, dare I say the word, Twitter, and there was Paul Schrader saying, "This is the great film of the year." And it was interesting to me because I had been thinking about Taxi Driver as I was watching Oppenheimer. And I thought these two films are both constructed as psychodramas. And they are psychodramas about alienated male characters who have a vision of the apocalypse. And Obviously, Travis is nothing like Oppenheimer, but in the way the movies are formed as psychodramas, they are. They have that very singular screen presence.
Yeah.
So that was so interesting to me that Schrader was so enthusiastic about this movie.
Yeah, I saw that too, and I thought it was interesting as well. I mean, it seemed like, yeah, that drive, there was something of the movie's drive of the psychodrama, this single-mindedness of Oppenheimer, and, you know, how that compares to maybe protagonists in a Schrader film. Did you see the photo that went with it? That I guess it must have been a selfie that Schrader did with Nolan.
Yes.
Nolan's expression is priceless. It's sort of like, okay, it's like, but it's great. I mean, it makes sense. And that's puzzling to me about being confused by the narrative. I mean, it's a very, like, what's the word? That's like very muscular. It's like, I think Nolan described it at some point, like an action movie about, I don't know, scientists or something. And in the sense that it's as propulsive as one of his other movies that are switching between, you know, nine different things. It's as propulsive as that is, except it's about the process of the project and then the political aspects of it. And it doesn't let up. And I was almost at a certain point, I kind of wished I had like a stopwatch, because at a certain point I began to feel if he had some general rule that he didn't want any scene, even dramatic, just like a conversational scene, last longer than a certain length of time, because it was just a constant forward motion to it. And I don't know, it was definitely dense. I mean, the exact political machinations of this, you know, the story of his undoing, the fall, as you mentioned, I mean, that's a little confusing because it's kind of devious. So, you know, I mean, you know, how he was maneuvered into something. And I actually thought in some ways that was as impressive as the first part, the Manhattan Project, because it's this story of backroom dealings. It's kind of like,
exactly.
If the first half is about like great minds, the second half is like small mindedness. I mean, I guess they were surveilling him even before they recruited him. But anyway, it's also a movie that's just like, I saw it as like Oppenheimer is like a movie about project management. <You know? laughs> I don't know. Do you have this sense about Nolan that I feel like at least two or three of his movies, this one included, are about making movies. I mean, I guess that's kind of...
Yeah.
This one especially, you know, which is maybe a little self-aggrandizing if he really does think about it that way. Maybe he's just doing it.
I think he's just doing it.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of big Hollywood movies are reflexive in that way. But this is so clearly that. I mean, here he is building the town of Los Alamos from scratch in the middle of the desert because he wants to have that town look like that town. And he's shooting in, you know, 70 millimeter film, which is almost absurd at this point. And the enterprise of the making of this movie is very much, you know, like the enterprise of building the bomb, but it has no consequences. Except it could be a financial disaster. That's all that will happen if this movie doesn't work. And that's where the processes part ways. You know, this could be a personal failure for Nolan, which it is not. Although I doubt that they'll make back their money. I don't know who's going to go to this movie after they finish with the IMAX hype. I just can't imagine that this movie is going to make a lot of money.
I'm a little doubtful about that, too. I mean, I'd like to think that suddenly America will be struck with, you know, Oppenheimer fever, and like everyone will suddenly want to watch, you know, 2 hours of people arguing about how to build a bomb. But I don't know. Maybe not. But I felt like there's a real integrity to the movie. I felt that I wasn't really expecting, because there is a way that it could be just a kind of an aggrandizing account. But the fact that he sticks with this, I mean, where, you know, Robert Downey Jr. playing Louis Strauss, a figure where, I mean, if I'm understanding correct, he basically kind of had a grudge or kind of had a vendetta he stuck to, at least in the film's telling, that in some way motivated him to help take Oppenheimer down a peg and kind of set him up. And it gets very explicit about that and kind of pulling back the curtain on political backroom stuff in a way, like, not again to extend the Nolan thing, but I flashed in my head, wait, Is this movie actually about how Nolan was huge for Warner Brothers, and then abruptly they said they were going to put his movies on streaming, and he felt betrayed somehow?
Yeah, no, I think that's pushing it. But I think that the Strauss character is really interesting one because it is a personal vendetta, but it's also McCarthyism. You know, he is so terrified that something will come out about him in the middle of McCarthyism. You know, the guy is just a total creep and a coward. And he's not going to let any ideas that he might have been somehow involved with people who were communists rub off on him. I mean, he's just so determined that that won't happen. And I do think that that section of the movie, the kind of show trial of Oppenheimer, is really about and is very accurate in terms of McCarthyism. And seems a lot like the show trials, you know, when I turn on MSNBC and I see these guys trying to interrogate whoever they've got up there. It's so extraordinary and appalling.
No, I really like that idea that the show trials have just become like primetime entertainment. Basically, they've become just that's the format of these shows now, and the groupthink of it all. Well, I guess since Nolan went to the trouble of doing it in shooting in 70mm and everything, I mean, I do have to say that it looks spectacular. I liked how the actual Trinity test.
Yeah, and where he puts it, I mean, he puts it exactly 2 hours into a 3 hour movie. It isn't what the movie builds to, and then you have a little aftermath, you know? I mean, that is just, I think, the most brilliant choice. And of course, it does look terrifying and spectacular. I'm sure a lot of people will drop all kinds of psychedelics before they go to this movie, but they really shouldn't. Because this movie could really terrify you if your brain wasn't together. But the other thing about this is most of it, except for the Trinity test, is built around Cillian Murphy's face. I mean, this is a movie where, you know, the face is the size of the exploding bomb, and it has that kind of impact on the screen. I mean, most extraordinary performance.
I totally agree, and it is really. I always wondered why we don't see more of Cillian Murphy generally. I guess he's been on a show, but one that I never really watched, the Peaky Blinders. But yeah, his the way I saw it, he's perfect because you look at him and it's you already see like the stakes written on his face because there's something about Murphy's face that he has almost has a stricken quality already, and his eyes have a way of looking already occupied, preoccupied in some way. I mean, it helps that he also can project all of that. Just what it suggests immediately is almost ghost-like. Even more so than like I think Nolan said like, oh, he looked just sort of like Oppenheimer. I mean, I don't know about that, but I think it's. I mean, he has the kind of movie version of hauntedness that I don't know that Oppenheimer's own face actually has. So it was suitable for, I don't know, dramatic purposes. But yeah, and then he also has this kind of faraway intensity in how he talks. And it's good to also to have him as an anchor, to have that actor as an anchor, because there are a lot of people in this movie. And there were points where I was like, oh man, is this going to feel like, it just seems like anytime another person's like, oh, that actor's in this movie too. You know, it's almost like too much, you know, it's like, wait, you know, Benny Safdie is playing, you know, Teller. I mean, people say that about like Asteroid City or something, or Wes Anderson movies, where there's just like so many famous people. And for me, like in the Wes Anderson movies, it makes sense because, like, in a weird way, it enhances the intimacy because, like, there's a family aspect to it, like a recurring troupe aspect. So that makes sense to me. But in Oppenheimer, also Matt Damon is just on such a different register, you know?
But sometimes I'm not sure that works. I mean, there's something about the script of this movie. I was with a friend who was really concerned because he didn't get every line. And I said, well, it might be my hearing, but I don't get every line either because I think that's the way the movie is mixed. The movie is mixed as a soundscape, and the score is amazing. And for lots of it, the dialogue becomes just another element with the score and the concrete sound. And I think that is one of the most extraordinary things. And Nolan always does that extremely well. The only person that you never missed a line was Matt Damon. And it was because of his delivery. And because of that, I started thinking, well, maybe the script isn't that good because I can understand every word he says.
That's funny. Yeah, it is. It is true. I mean, I also love the score, and I've generally like the scores in Nolan movies. I mean, I happen to enjoy Tenet. I really love the score for Tenet. It's just one of these like incredible feats of like sustaining tension in like an almost ridiculous way, in a way kind of comparable to Mad Max Fury Road's score, which I also love. I always feel like Christopher Nolan must have listened to a lot of electronica in the 90s. I don't know, or like Warp Records and stuff, because
I'm sure.
And so that's kind of what I hear in these scores, is, and that works here because there's something otherworldly about the whole Atomic Project. So I love the score here, and his mixes, yeah, have to the point of it's almost being eccentric at times. I was listening to just the Bane voice again from the Dark Knight movies, you know, like it's crazy. It's like, it's something Michel Chion would have loved to write about, you know. It's in your head. It's like a radio drama. It's bizarre. It's nowhere on screen. So it's just funny to see these kind of instruments and techniques he has exerted on subject matter like this. It's my favorite like atomic related movie since the Twin Peaks.
And the other thing that I think is remarkable is in this very large cast, some of whom are Nolan favorites playing tiny, tiny parts, but I never had a problem thinking, well, that person just seems too stupid to be, you know, involved in particle physics. I mean, they all seem eccentric and like they could be that intelligent, which is rare, you know, so rare.
Even Josh Hartnett?
Even Josh Hartnett, yes.
Yeah, it is funny how Kenneth Branagh, I don't know, whatever he means for Nolan, to have him in there, he is... Who is he? Niels Bohr? Is that who he plays?
Yeah, he plays Niels Bohr.
I'm having these flashbacks to like, you know, some like high school physics class, like suddenly seeing all these names that I haven't heard. Like, you know, is Enrico Fermi, is he in this movie?
Yes, he is.
it's like, I'd love to see class trips go to this, to Oppenheimer, which also would be funny because of the whole psychosexual thread to the movie, which actually was expecting more of a reaction to in write-ups. I mean, what he does with the Bhagavad Gita line, my jaw dropped.
Yeah, and I think she's, I don't usually like her that much, but I think she's great in this movie.
Yeah, in a tough part. I mean, like a biographical movie, that's a tough role to have, but I thought she was great too. I thought she also, she's filmed beautifully too. I mean.
Yeah, well, I thought both women were really, really good.
Yeah.
And that their characters were really interesting. And when she gets up and testifies, Emily Blunt, I hate to say it, but I cried.
Yeah.
You know, I thought she was so strong.
Yeah.
And that was an amazing scene.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I know it's part of the history, but the movie would be pretty crushing, or even more crushing without her there.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, in those scenes in the little, whatever that is, like conference room. I think at the end of that, if I remember correctly, the camera, we're like point of view, like senators, you know, I think, you remember they kind of put the camera at the long end of the table so that we're looking at him. And it, I don't know, it's kind of.
I mean, I want to go back and see this movie simply to look at how he does the point of view shots.
Yeah.
Because it is largely, it's a psychodrama. It's largely Oppenheimer's point of view.
Yeah.
And he uses the switch to black and white, which I'm not totally convinced by, for Robert Downey Jr.'s point of view.
Right.
I mean, that's what the black and white stuff is. It's his world, which is literally a black and white world, as opposed to, and maybe that's too literal. I mean, he's a bad guy. He sees no nuance. He sees everything in terms of black and white, in terms of how he can play his advantage.
Yeah. I mean, for Downey, I thought that was great piece of casting, that this guy who I think is great actor, but has sort of just been charming his way through movies.
Exactly.
You know, and to kind of channel that. Murphy, it was also pretty charming. I thought he got a good sense of like how, I mean, this sort of thing is almost disastrous when like a run-of-the-mill biopic tries to show how like someone is like charming their way at parties or something, but I kind of found it persuasive when he was doing it. Not just an atomic intellectual powerhouse, but also
he's a very sexy guy in this movie. I don't know if Oppenheim was, but in this movie he certainly is.
Yeah. I'm totally the same way. I need to, it's kind of like getting hit by a freight train a little bit. Like I want to see it again. When I saw it, it was not like a public audience. And I'm so curious what that would be like, you know, just to feel the room for that. Because, you know, it's an attempt. It's like an attempt to make something about these stakes, about the loggerheads of, or crossroads of like science and life, you know, and, you know, moral stakes land or resonate, you know. And, you know, even before I saw it, I definitely thought, oh, this is clearly about AI, you know. This is about being at this point of unleashing and harnessing some new technology, but without really a blueprint of what happens afterwards. Mm-hmm. And then sure enough, he's been talking about AI. He said something like, I talked to scientists and they're like, this is our Oppenheimer moment. He talked to AI scientists and he's like, this is our Oppenheimer moment. I was like, okay, I guess. Well, we'll see. But definitely, yeah, I also wonder, you know, you said, like, are people going to come out to this? Because it's like, you know, Dunkirk, that also came out during the summer. And, you know, these are the kind of like summer downer movies, you know?
Right.
A little bit similar to Dunkirk, too, in that they're both countdown movies. I mean, there's not like literal ticking in this one, at least. But yeah, at least 2 hours of this is a countdown movie.
I mean, it's interesting that summer blockbuster movies are movies usually in which things get blown up. They're not real things.
Right.
This is a movie in which something, there's a very big thing that blows up.
That's true.
And it's too horribly real.
Yeah, it is. No, it's funny. I mean, in a way, I guess, yeah, that ends up being kind of reflexive about the imagination of, of that kind of spectacle. It'd be interesting to think about, were there more explosions in movies after the Trinity test, once you kind of capture the imagination. Also, while researching this, I guess, I always thought the word blockbuster had to do with people lining up around the block for a movie. Uh-huh. But then I read that it's actually because of blockbuster bombs, like a kind of bomb that
really?
Huge bomb, yeah. But this is one of these internet things where, like, I don't know what the truth is anymore, so I just got to find a book.
Wow.
Yeah. It's also, what is it? Yeah, it's a full, it's just about 3 hours, isn't it, or more?
It is 3 hours and 1 minute.
3 hours and 1 minute, yeah.
And for me, I did look at my watch when the bomb finally goes off because I wanted to see where that happened. And it's just on 2 hours.
Yeah.
But I was never looking at my watch. I mean, I was just totally with this movie for 3 hours. I never left it. You know, I didn't feel that it should be shorter or there was a big lag in the third act like some people seem to feel. I didn't.
No, people, not to speak for the people who feel there's a lag in the third act, but I have to think that that's based on just kind of expectations of like how a movie like this should go or how movies like this ordinarily would go, which is like, okay, the bomb's gone off, now we'll just kind of wind things down. But instead he like just draws out this like just excruciating dismantling of Oppenheimer.
And the most extraordinary scene, I think, in the movie is the congratulations scene when he has to go out there and all these people are cheering for the bomb having killed 120,000 Japanese in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he is just absolutely distraught. And they're all just cheering like imbeciles. I mean, that's the devastating scene in the movie for me.
Yeah, well, because he's been living in this bubble. That scene is incredible. Isn't there also, don't they also do like things to people's faces in that or something? Or like,
well, they cut out the sound at a certain point.
Yeah.
So you just see the faces and they're kind of cheering and their faces are all distorted. I don't know if they did anything to the image, but.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like one of those silent era things they do when they do like a montage of faces that all are kind of like frenzied with emotion, you know, or like in a Fritz Lang thing when you have the screen fills with faces or something like that. It's very visceral and it's Hate Week from 1984 flashed into my head, you know, just this bank of people cheering like mass death. It's a little unnerving. And also, I have to say, I like the way it handled his realization of that. I think there are movies where it could feel false that he's like, oh my God, what have I done? But I bought it in this, you know.
Absolutely.
Didn't feel like that kind of false turnaround, false self-consciousness. You feel it. And I think that's also down to Cillian Murphy, you know, a lot navigating that realization. I feel like this is a movie that I'm almost going to have to see again to digest and have more complete thoughts on.
Well, the only thing I want to add about Oppenheimer, besides the fact that it's just a lot of movie,
yeah,
you know, and I certainly will go see it again in theaters. I mean, I'm not going to wait till it streams. I want to see it again on a really big screen. But this week in Los Angeles at the Hammer Museum, there is an event. Bruce Conner, who was an avant-garde filmmaker and visual artist, grew up in Kansas and was in high school, I guess, after the bomb. And so duck and cover was part of his life. And he was terrified all of his life about the bomb. So terrified that at a certain point he moved to Mexico. But he made a film he actually got from the government footage of the tests of the hydrogen bomb. And he made this film called Crossroads out of that footage. The government footage, they had cameras 360 degrees around that Bikini Atoll test. And so he made this film called Crossroads, which was restored. And now Bruce, of course, is gone. But Michelle Silver, who restored Bruce's work, she is showing this at the Hammer Museum with Ross, who used to be at the UCLA archive. And he's made a making of this film. And so that's an event. And I'm hoping that someone brings that event to New York while this film is still in theaters, because that's an extraordinary film.
Yeah, that would be great. The footage of those tests, first of all, they're all bigger than the Trinity test. And, you know, they were like basically frying ships around it in the ocean. And it's just like a beast rising from the ocean. It just looks wrong. It's one of the things you look at and it's like, that shouldn't be happening.
Right.
I haven't seen that in a while, but I would love to see that again. Maybe someone can talk to Christopher Nolan. He'll set up some weird parallel screen. Because he seems like the guy who must have been like, show me all depictions ever of the atomic blast. And right. So he screened it at some point. I didn't mention, that was the way the blast is shown. They like partly cut out the audio so that you're hearing people breathing during the Trinity test.
And then the sound comes back.
Yeah.
Someone told me, or I read somewhere, that if you go see it in IMAX, because of the shape of the screen, you see people in the audience, or you're aware of them. And in that scene, when you get the full blast of the bomb, and there are people in the film who are lying on the ground, shielding themselves from the blast, but the blast is reflected on the faces of the people around you in the audience. So that's one reason that I wanted to see it in IMAX, to see if that was the case.
Oh, wow.
That you become aware of all the people around you lit up by the blast.
That's amazing. Yeah, I saw it in IMAX, but it was like a smaller group and everyone was like staying far from the screen because you can go dizzy if you're a little close to it. I mean, the thing about IMAX is I always feel like I'm looking at a projection on the side of a building. I mean, it's just like it feels like the height of like a walk up, you know, it's like,
right.
And so here, yeah, you just have a wall of flame. So that would be one reason to see it with a full crowd. Yeah, it's something. So that's, Oppenheimer, the beginnings of processing Oppenheimer for me, at least. And for whatever insane reason, I guess it was a game of release date chicken to to a certain extent.
Right.
Anyway, the other movie. I guess for other people, Oppenheimer is the other movie, but for me at least, Barbie is the other movie.
Yeah.
What did you make of Barbie?
Well, as I famously now seem to have said, it's a movie about a fucking doll. I have liked Greta's movies a lot in the past, but this was, I think, an unworkable project for any serious person to undertake. I mean, a movie about Barbie that's financed by Mattel, would there be any possibility it's anything except a very long product placement that has kind of kicky contemporary aspects to, oh, Barbie, she can be cool too. I think it's awful. You know, I mean, the more I think about it, the worse it gets. And that makes me feel kind of bad. But I am old. So Barbie came into the world in 1959. And by that time, I was a junior in college. So Barbie was not part of my universe. But I was very, very surprised in this movie. I mean, the opening scene kind of is a mock of the opening scene of 2001, only Barbie in her original striped, whatever the fuck that was, took the place of the artist. And all these little girls are playing with their baby dolls. And the movie actually says that Barbie came along, and before Barbie, the only dolls girls could have were babies. And so it was kind of placing them that the only thing they could do in the future was to become mothers. Well, I will tell you that between 1945 and 1950, there was a regular ritual in my family during Christmas, or more properly Hanukkah, that we went to FAO Schwartz to buy me presents. And in FAO Schwartz, I always picked out the doll of the year. And all the dolls I picked out were adult dolls. And at least three of them were taller than Barbie. So what is this myth that this movie is trying to propose? I had dozens of dolls that were, you know, grown-ups. They were 18-year-olds or 25-year-olds, or that's what they represented. I had a bride doll. I had a princess doll, each of them 3 feet tall. I had the entire family of Little Women. I had Anne of Green Gables. I had dolls of many nations. I had many, many, many adult dolls, and I only had one baby doll, and it was disgusting because you could feed it. It came with a bottle, and you could feed it water, you know, put the nipple in its mouth, and it would drink. And then you're supposed to make it pee by opening the little stopper in its belly button, which I just thought was so disgusting that I never did it. And so my baby dolls all rotted because they had water inside them.
I'm so glad to hear that because, I mean, not about the rotting dolls, I completely understand that, but about the adult things, because I heard that and I didn't grow up with dolls, but I thought that just, it just seems wrong. Like, how is that possible? It just kind of annoyed me to start off right off the bat. I'm always suspicious of like any history that starts off with erasing prior history, especially when it's about like a corporation's product. It's just like, well, okay, like very convenient to make that pronouncement. And actually, when I thought about, especially when it came out, the Barbie dolls, I guess I didn't realize that it was exactly in 59 until I started reading about it. And when I saw that date, I began to think, were the Barbies really about having adult dolls or kind of having respectable, well-behaved teenage dolls, basically, so that you kids...
Yes, that's what they were.
Yeah, because especially coming out of the 50s, you know, all sorts of like juvenile delinquent, you know, worries or propaganda about worries, you know, I thought that's speaking to a parent, you know, it's like, here, let them play with this instead of going off and smoking reefer or something. I don't know what are... aspiring to grow up and just play with these post-pubescent dolls at home, and that'll give them a good model for what to be when they're teenagers. So it didn't even necessarily have to do with being a grown adult with a career. The whole baby thing. I mean, it's a funny sequence, but also the more I would think about that 2001 sequence, it's funny. I have a sense of humor, but also it's kind of like, really? Like the obelisk is like it just starts to seem like ominous that
Exactly.
I don't know. And then so much of the movie is just declarative, which is, I guess, what a lot of people want.
Well, I mean, the movie tries to have a certain kind of credibility and irony by enlisting Helen Mirren to do a voiceover explaining everything that's going on. And Helen Mirren is very good at a kind of double entendre, so that this is a movie in which, this is the world of Barbie, but we also all realize that Barbie is a doll that is made by a corporation, which is also part of this movie. And in that way, it's like it has a boardroom with all men in it, just like Oppenheimer has a boardroom with guys in it.
Right.
But I mean, there is something so disingenuous about this movie in the end. And I don't think that Greta Gerwig is disingenuous as a filmmaker. It's just a kind of bind that she got herself into that there was no way to get out of, because it's a movie about a Mattel product that's trying to make that product appealing at this moment when it isn't appealing. Barbie is not, there is no way to reinvent Barbie so that at this moment, Barbie can be in any way appealing. And when I read women critics writing about this movie, saying that, there is a speech in this movie or Greta Gerwig is a great feminist, I just think, well, the reason that we are in this terrible situation, women having all of the rights to own their own bodies, is because people like that think that Barbie is some version of feminism. I mean, it's so awful, this movie, in that way.
It is a little awkward that this comes out that the summer after that last summer. I mean, the idea that somehow the movie is going to rehabilitate Barbie by having pseudo subversive, and also just I don't also I have to wonder people who watch the movie and call it like the most subversive blockbuster. I don't subversive to me is like Idiocracy, which is a movie that was like literally buried. I mean, like. Because it accurately predicted the rise of like an entertainment figure for president. And even in terms of subversive movies about products, like the Lego Movie animated movies, they're kind of actually kind of funnier. Yeah, I don't know how subversive it is.
They don't have sexual politics built into them.
Yeah, well, that's
And
true.
Barbie has to. You have to deal with the sexual politics of Barbie.
Yeah.
And this movie does it really badly.
I don't know. I do feel weird as a man like bashing this movie, but I have to say I went into it wanting to have nothing but like watch an intelligent, cleverly made and funny movie. I have to wonder because we did see it at the same screening room. I felt there was zero depth, visual depth to this movie. Did you feel that way? Like there are these musical numbers where it's like there's clearly like three planes of action going on here, but I can't even like appreciate that's going on.
It's totally frontal.
Yeah.
It just all the setups seem totally frontal. And maybe that's deliberate because in the Barbie world,
Yeah.
I don't know, things are have no depth. But when Barbie goes to the real world, there's no depth either. It is absolutely flat. And I do think in an odd way, Ryan Gosling is very, very good. I mean, he seems to be operating in a way that's independent of the rest of the movie. I mean, he knows that this is high camp, or he knows that he can make Ken into a high camp character. And that is not in accordance with anything else in the movie, but he does that, and he does that really well.
Yeah.
But in the end, in terms of the narrative or the politics of the movie, it's just totally meaningless. Like, oh yeah, Ken always was a camp character.
It's It was weird, but that the whole little experiment of like him realizing what patriarchy is and that whole flipping thing was actually more effective as like a satirical point than a lot of else in the movie. Like the way that satirical element of the film was constructed just worked better. I mean, in this movie we're like mired in like chase scenes or like some, it just ended up feeling very conventional. Well, what did you make of when they introduced the creator, capital C, when they introduce Ruth Handler and they have this kind of conversation between her and Barbie in what looks like the afterlife? It's basically like this completely, empty zone.
Well, Ruth Handler explains that Barbie was for her a wish fulfillment character for a woman who had a double mastectomy and then was indicted and kicked out of the company for, I don't know, doing something bad with money. But the thing that she never says, she does say, I had a double mastectomy. And that might have something to do with being an Ashkenazi Jew, because, there is no Jewish Barbie. There's every kind of Barbie, but there are no Jewish Barbies, not in this movie and not in real life. Ruth Handler was Jewish and Barbie was the ultimate shiksa. And somehow that point is never made in this movie, and it would have been a better movie if it hadn't.
That's really interesting. I'm sure like the way she would explain the movie is fascinating, but like actually watching it is like another thing, I mean, she talks about, is it the Times interview where she talks about how it's like, I think she's basically comparing it to like the expulsion from Eden or something like that, or like,
There's Milton she brings up and all kinds of stuff. And I think that I really like Greta Gerwig's first two films. I mean, I really like Little Women, and I really like the first film. And I think that Noah Baumbach's films got better when Greta Gerwig was at the center of them.
I think that's true.
So I just think that this is some kind of misbenighted project, and I hope she puts it behind her and goes on and does more interesting things. That's all I can say.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I think it probably will do well enough, could be pretty successful. But the weird thing is that the next thing she has lined up is another ostensibly big budget of a different franchise, a different kind of franchise, or of the Narnia books, which at that point I'm like, I mean, I don't know. I can't review a movie that hasn't even been made. But yeah, I honestly wish I had had more fun at Barbie. Well, of course, appreciating the subversive aspect. Well, yeah, Barbie's Barbie.
But I mean, it's just one more thing.
Yeah.
It's also maybe unfair, but putting them together in the way they've been put together,
Yeah.
you have this thought in your unconscious that guys like Christopher Nolan make movies about serious things like the atomic bomb, and women make films about Barbie. And that is a thought I do not like to have in my head.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. I mean, she's like bending over backwards to try to make something more of it. And I don't know what to do with the fact that, a number of critics who I do like their work are enthusiastic about Barbie. And I don't really know, I don't know what to make of it. For me, it just, the subversiveness felt like it was being read out to me and didn't feel as if it was like actually being enacted or acted out. I don't know. I'm just going to go in circles on this one. Also, yeah, not to say that like I automatically thought, I would say of the two movies, I was more wary of what Oppenheimer was going to be. Anyway. Oh, well, there's something else that really got we'll talk about. And I had no idea until you told me about it. So this is a Steven Soderbergh series, but not the series that people might even think of when they say the latest Soderbergh series. Can you explain the phenomenon of Command Z?
Yeah. So Command Z is a series that Steven Soderbergh seems to have made in his basement in his spare time, sometime toward the end of COVID. I mean, it's interesting to think of a filmmaker like Soderbergh who just works so hard avoiding big movies, right? He really doesn't anymore want to make the big grand statement. In a way, I think maybe, I don't know, he's gone too far in that direction. He just wants to make these workmanlike entertainments that are well made, and each one is different from the other, and they're all really very good. And he has, you know, he doesn't have to worry about making money or anything like that. And sometimes he can put his own money into something. And so this project, Command Z, which didn't used to be called that, and it's now called Command Z for a specific reason that I just figured out. Anyway, he seems to have made this project in his studio that he set up. And it's a kind of, I mean, I think of it as a cross between Chris Marker's La Jetée, Mr. Rogers, and I don't know, something else I threw in there when I was thinking about it. It's all together, it's 90 minutes, it's in 8 parts, irregular length. And basically the premise is, it's sometime in the future, and these employees for a company which is now run by a totally AI character is told that there is a way that they might be able to keep the world from coming to an end, because they are in some kind of post-apocalyptic thing where they're walking around in big raincoats and they have to cross some divide in the city.
The seawall.
And that they could avoid everything going to hell simply by going back in time to 2023 and influencing people who have a lot of power back there. And the way that people can get into other people's brains is that, and it's a very funny joke, that during the pandemic, people's brains were made vulnerable by something that was in hand sanitizer. Hand sanitizer somehow softened people's brains so that someone else could use this as a way to get inside them. So they go back, each of them, through this portal that's inside a washing machine, a super high-end washing machine.
Yeah, that's good.
It isn't that funny on the screen, but it's funny to talk about. And they, you know, try to influence these people with a lot of power. Anyway, Soderbergh did not know what to do with this series. Clearly, I guess it couldn't, it's not the kind of thing you could stream it on Netflix or anything. And so he said, well, I'm just going to put it out there. And he changed the name to Command Z. And he did two things with it. It's up now on his website. And his website, for people who don't know, it's a great website. Extension 765. You can buy great t-shirts on this website. You can see those funny lists that he makes every year. Yeah. Everything I've seen read over the past year. And you can get Command Z, not for free, but you have to pay, and the proceeds go to 2 nonprofits. One is Children's Aid, and the other is Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research. But he also showed it one afternoon last week at Metrograph. And this was part of the introduction and a conversation between Soderbergh and the youngest congressman, Maxwell Frost, who is from the middle of Florida, some district near Orlando. And he is the youngest congressman. He's 26. He has a long history in political organizing, and he's great. And so they had this wonderful conversation that had nothing to do with this piece at all, but just about how you organize Generation Z, which is why the name of this piece got changed to Command Z.
Ah, I get it now. Okay.
And that was fantastic. And this guy is really, really impressive. And now I get daily emails from him, and I'm looking for, and I ended up sending him money, and then he wants more money, and then he wants more money. But he is a really, really smart guy and a great organizer. And, you know, he is the kind of person one wants in politics. And so in an odd way, this is, it's a strange companion piece to the Christopher Nolan movie. Mm. It is a political organizing tool, Command Z, and this whole enterprise. And I wonder where Soderbergh is going to go with this, because he's been talking a lot and thinking a lot about how these movies and series and how this cultural work can somehow feed into real politics and real change.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I've started watching them, and the series is a kind of way of organizing. The connection for me works because the series is kind of wishful thinking, at least as far as I've gone through, you know.
Yeah.
It's this wishful idea that you'll be able to change the future, but from the vantage point of when it's just about too late or almost too late. And it puts you in that mindset, which of course is going to be, you know, futile or is going to feel futile, as fun as it is to think about it. Which then for me at least makes me think, well, then what actually do you do? You know, what actually can you do? And also the way I'm trying not to give away too much that happens in the series, really. But like a lot of it's about like influencing people's behavior. So it's also kind of implants that idea of how you might do that and what might actually cause people to change their minds or change their behavior, which is, you know, politics.
Exactly. And it's politics in terms of we all feel overwhelmed and, you know, maybe it is too late to save us from being, you know, roasted, like boiled alive like lobsters. But the idea that, well, let us not think about the huge things that we can't do, but incremental change might be possible and it might be empowering, you know?
Yeah.
It might make you feel less helpless so you could go on and make bigger changes.
Yeah. When we talked about this movie on a previous episode, but like that's something that kind of made a light bulb go on in my head was watching High Flying Bird. I mean, that felt like a movie where they're basically giving you a book at the end, like, you know, think about this, you know, the whole movie is kind of about like, think about this, you know, like, and so it feels of a piece with that. And honestly, when I heard this about this dropping, I mean, I don't know if this part was kind of more coincidental, but like the fact that the SAG strikes started this week, and then it was more or less after that that I heard about this, you know, I felt like, oh, it's like, it's like in High Flying Bird where they start doing pickup matches, you know,
right?
Pickup basketball when everything's shut down so that people realize there's an alternative. I don't know if that was intentional at all, but it definitely feels like truly independent, which is something that I always feel like he's coming back to, you know, what is actual like independence in a constructive way? What does that look like? You know, what is empowering about it? I started wondering, do people use their mouse more often? People do know that Command Z is the undo keyboard shortcut. That's not forgotten, right? That's...
Oh, I actually didn't think of that.
The undo command for, I don't know, I think like Word and maybe other programs too.
I never learned any of those commands, you know, use my mouse.
That's what I was wondering. Well, yeah, I'm curious. I hope enough people see it. I also thought it interesting because I guess, I don't know if he's done something like this before, but it's also, it's basically a web series. I mean, that's, I guess, what you'd call it, both the length of the individual episodes and the way that it's out there. And for my money, from what I've seen so far, I found it like very just entertaining as well. I don't know.
It is. I was actually surprised that it looked, when it was projected at Metrograph, that it looked really good.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, in that kind of, you know, indie, creative, chintzy way. Yeah. It looked really...
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny. They have... Michael Cera has a role in it where he's projected, basically. And it also has this kind of fuzzy, muzzy kind of quality. And I don't know. There's a lot of, like, funny, like, speculation about the future in it that I'm sort of like, yeah, that could probably happen. You know, it's probably what's going to happen. And the whole thing, yeah, is only, like, what is it, hour 40 total or something like that?
I think, yeah, it's that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's great to talk about that because, you know, as you said with Oppenheimer, I mean, all three of these things that we've talked about are they are in their different ways trying to be with varying degrees of success. I don't know. I never liked the word political films. So what would be the way to describe we're trying to change minds in some ways?
I mean, I think all films are political, but
Yeah.
these are trying to open a portal into our time, something like that,
Yeah.
so we could look at it differently. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, they have content, which is these days is pretty rare. Their content is important in all of them.
Yeah. And it's interesting how each of them does that. I mean, Barbie by literally setting up these parallel worlds, and Oppenheimer, I guess the more traditional method of like, you know, the great man story and what we might learn from it. But just really good. And commands the dystopia, I guess. But I haven't finished it, so I don't know how it ends up. But yeah.
We have talked about the other Soderbergh series.
I think you had just started watching it and you were positive on it, but I'm not sure how much more. I haven't finished that one either. I need to finish that one.
Yeah, no, I think it's terrific. What I said about it is, I think some people, including me, the first two episodes are so loaded with information that if you watch things because you enjoy the expressivity that great filmmakers can achieve with, moving images and sound, well, you can't quite get that in the first two episodes because you're so busy trying to figure out who is who and what the fucking story is.
Yeah.
And so it didn't kick in for me till episode three. And then it just got better and better, and it moves. I mean, we were talking about how the Christopher Nolan film moves. This moves, it never stops. And the shots are so clipped, and the editing is so great, and the whole thing is so propulsive. And when you get to the end, then I just went back and watched the whole thing all over again. And then I didn't have a problem with the first two episodes. So I suggest that anyone who looks at it, get through the beginning, go to the end, and then watch it again.
Yeah, it moves, and with every scene, there's like another kink, and there's another bit of strategizing that goes on with the characters. So that's also great. And I love that you have this basically like bomb thrower intelligence in it with the Zazie Bates character.
Yeah.
She's.
And this kind of face-off throughout between the Zazie Bates character and her counterpoint, the mother, Claire Danes. And toward the end, they have, these confrontational scenes that are really very, very good scenes between two women who come from totally different worlds, but are basically on the same page by the end.
Oh,
Yeah,
wow. Okay. I haven't
really
gone
good.
to that. Okay.
And then, there are the three characters who come to the US knowing nothing about what they're going to get into. And they're totally unknown actors, a woman and two men, and they are fantastic. I mean, they are actually the best thing in the series.
No, I'm looking forward to finishing that.
Did we say what the name of the
Don't
series
think we
is?
did.
Okay.
It's a full circle, full circle.
Yeah.
And it's on, I'm still calling it,
HBO
I still
Max.
call it HBO Max, because like Max, I don't, it sounds like I'm leaving something out. And I only just think of like, I mean, when we had cable boxes, Max was just Cinemax, so it's very confusing for me. Anyway, but it's on HBO Max slash Max.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've watched other stuff, but I don't know that I have anything left to say. I did rewatch Buffalo 66, which I haven't seen in ages. Which is on Mubi right now, which was sort of a surprise to me because for some reason I thought it was a movie that was like very hard to see, but it was right there, so I guess now it's not that hard to see. Although as far as I know, he's doesn't let the later movies be screened at all or something, or the later one.
Really?
Yeah, I thought that like the one that's got water in the title, the long title that was at Toronto and then just was like disappeared. I mean, Brown Bunny is seeable, but he did that other one that's got like promises written in water. I don't think he allows that to be screened anymore.
I don't think I've ever seen it.
Anyway, so yeah, that was fun to see Buffalo 66. And I feel like a certain era is like, I'm like reliving because now there's like, you saw the Richard Kelly, I know you saw the Richard Kelly screenings that are coming up.
Yes.
Donnie Darko and The Box.
I showed Donnie Darko. One of the reasons I teach is I like to turn kids on to these movies. And there are always about five students who come up to me after I show Donnie Darko, and they say, this movie changed my life. And that makes me so happy because I think Donnie Darko is one of the great coming of age movies.
Yeah.
So that's at the Roxy on the 26th of this month.
Yeah.
And he's going to be there, and they're showing it in 35 mil, which they show at the Roxy a lot.
Yeah, they definitely show it a bunch. No, that's going to be great. I'm going to try to go to that. I mean, I don't think I've seen it on a screen since forever. I don't know.
And on the 25th, they're showing The Box.
The Box.
Which is a very good genre movie.
It is, yeah.
I think of it as the movie where Richie Kelly was trying to prove to the powers that be that he wasn't a total lunatic and they could trust him with some money, you know, after the disaster of Southland Tales, which I think it's a great movie. You know, I'm one of the huge fans of Southland Tales. And I wish the Roxy was showing that.
Yeah, I wonder why they didn't. Maybe they're saving it. Maybe they'll do it again. They'll do it after this. I don't know. I mean, talk about that one's like subversive, like nightmare futurescape. I mean, like.
Absolutely. And it just becomes more and more of our time every year.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of crazy to go back to that one. Yeah. And the way he was using casting in that is also like, I'm actually not even sure I can recapture how weird some of that was at the time. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Glad to celebrate the unofficial Barbie Oppenheimer and not complete it with the chaser of Command Z. I hope everyone sees all these movies and sees for themselves.
Yeah, that movies still do matter, even though, you know, sometimes in the dead of night, I think they don't, but they do.
Yes. Well, I can't think of a better way of ending, so we'll finish it there.
Thank you, Nick. Bye.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music from their song, Montserrat. Thank you for listening.